I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to go back in time a bit and listen to some inspiring oratory and remember a decade that was a really hard one. If you lived through it, you'll remember how difficult the 60s were. And our guest has written this wonderful biography of Bobby Kennedy. Larry Tye is our guest. The book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. He was a hero of Larry's, actually, when he was a kid in high school. And the book looks at, a lot of books have been written about Bobby Kennedy, but Larry says we remember him as a racial hero, healer, a tribune for the poor and the last progressive person, an uncommon optimist in an age of political distrust who would later inspire Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Each man stands up for an ideal. He sends forth a tiny ripple of hope and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring. They build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. No wonder he inspired so many people. But earlier, and Larry spends time on this because not many people have, he started his public life as a counsel, as you recall, to Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. He took on Jimmy Hoffa, and he was a fierce anti-communist. And the book is also, interestingly, about the transformation from cold warrior to, as Larry describes him, hot-blooded liberal. And it is filled with so many, many stories. We're going to hear from Larry during the course of this hour. He's a New York Times bestselling author of many books, including The Father of Spin, Homelands, Shock, Satchel. He runs the Boston-based Health Coverage Fellowship, which helps the media do good work on reporting on public health, mental health, and high-tech medicine. He was an award-winning reporter at the Boston Globe, and he covered the Kennedys again and again for that wonderful publication from 1986 to 2001. And he's taught journalism at a number of great places, and he's our guest this hour. And we'll be welcoming phone calls and hearing a little bit during the course of the hour, because some of you who are alive now probably don't know very much about Bobby Kennedy. And for those of you who were alive during those years, you'll have vivid memories, I'm sure. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we would love to hear your messages about this. Larry, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, I loved your book. I'm about 70 pages short of finishing it, and I tried to stay awake last night, but I just had to get some sleep. It's so good. It's just, I was alive during that time, and I remember him. And then this morning, we listened to some of the speeches that he gave, and you were a fan of his when you were in high school, weren't you?
I was. I went to high school with his middle child, his most troubled son, and that helped inspire me, and I started out the book an enormous hero of Bobby Kennedy. I spent the book looking at his upsides and downsides, and despite his flaws, ended up as much of a hero. He ended up as much of a hero as when I started.
Yeah, and perhaps because he could make that transformation. He really made a transformation through the eyes of poor people and Indian people and people who were not getting a fair shake of the American dream.
So that's true, and today we're more cynical, and we would call a transformation like that a flip-flop.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a sincere change of heart, a change of circumstances for him and for the country. And if a politician can't change, then what's the point of having him around? And I think he did it in a way that gives good a good sense of the possibility of change to other people in politics.
So let's start with those early years when he worked as a counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy for, I believe, about 7 months. How did that come about, and how fierce was his anti-communism, Kennedy's, that is?
So he went to work for Joe McCarthy, Kathleen, for two reasons. One was because his father told him to, and in those days, anything that Bobby Kennedy's dad, the famous Joseph P. Kennedy, said, Bobby generally did. And he was a guy who didn't have a good job at that point. Joe Kennedy had given a lot of money to Joe McCarthy and believed in him. And so when Joe Kennedy said, you ought to take a job with Joe McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy would have done it just for that reason. But the more important thing as we go back and look at that is that Bobby Kennedy believed in the anti-communist movement. It was a time in the early 1950s when the Soviet Union really did pose a threat to America, and when it was at least believable, whether or not true, that there was a communist behind every pillar in the State Department, the way Joe McCarthy was saying. So Bobby Kennedy felt that the only politician in Washington who had the courage to stand up to the communists was Joe McCarthy, and he enthusiastically went to work for him.
And came to his funeral, picked up by somebody from the Milwaukee Journal in Green Bay and taken to his funeral, is that right?
It is. If I can take 2 seconds and tell you that story, I think
yes, please.
Who Bobby Kennedy was. So there's a funeral in 1957 in Appleton, Wisconsin, and in the nearest airport in Green Bay, an enormous plane flies in there. And the plane, out of the plane, get 19 U.S. senators, 7 congressmen, and a bunch of other dignitaries. And they do what dignitaries generally do. They pile into large black limousines, and they drive off to the nearby airport in Appleton where McCarthy's being buried. When the runway seems quiet and it looks like there's nobody else around, one last person gets off that plane, and it is a small, thin, young congressional staffer named Robert Francis Kennedy. Hmm. As you said, nobody's around there, no more limousines, no taxis. He bums a ride to the funeral by this reporter from the Wisconsin newspaper. When he gets to the church, he goes way up in the choir loft where nobody can see him and watches from there. When he gets to the graveside, he watches off to the side. Everybody else is in one part of the cemetery. Bobby Kennedy is over somewhere else. When the funeral is over, he does what politicians could get away with doing back then. He asks all the reporters there, would you mind not mentioning when you write your stories that I was here? And they oblige because he was a respected figure from Washington and, more importantly, because he was a Kennedy, and people did what Kennedy's asked. And I think his being there says two things about him. On the one hand, it is the upstanding, loyal side of Bobby Kennedy. He had believed in Joe McCarthy, and when Joe McCarthy was riding high, Bobby Kennedy graciously accepted a job with him and learned a lot in the 7.5 months that he worked for him. So that was the guy saying, I don't care what the country and the Senate might have condemned him, but he was my friend and I'm darn well going to be there. But if that was the upside, the other side was the sort of savvy spinmeister side, and he knew what wouldn't be good for his brother Jack, who was going to run for president in a few years, to have had his little brother show up at the funeral of right. The most condemned conservative in America. So he was there and made sure that he was going to the funeral, even though Jack told him not to, but he also made sure that nobody knew he was there.
No wonder he was such a great campaign manager for his brother, right?
A brilliant one.
Absolutely. And, well, let's take that story then to talk about the transformation that takes place, because he goes later with Chief Justice Douglas to Russia. And as is true of his going to the Mississippi Delta, as is true of his going to Bedford-Stuyvesant, as is true of his going to Vietnam and many other places, South Africa, he's really kind of transformed by what he sees. And he sees something in Russia that the stance gets a little softer, doesn't it? The anti-communist stance?
So it does. And like everything in his life, the more he was willing to go on the ground and actually watch things and see what happened for himself, the more his myths about just how bad the communists were begin to be transformed. He never felt a whole lot better about the Soviet government, but he began to understand the Soviet people were like American people, and they were people who, whatever their supposed politics, could be talked to, were worth negotiating with. He got a more nuanced sense. He went with the most liberal member of the Supreme Court then and maybe ever, in Justice William O. Douglas. Douglas didn't especially want to take him, but Douglas was a pal of Joe Kennedy's, and Joe said, take my son and show him the world. And Douglas did that. And when he came back, he had a more balanced view of what this horrible communist threat was. And again, as we were saying, so if the Kennedy boys had gone into the priesthood the way their very religious mother Rose had dreamed that they would, Jack Kennedy would have been a pope. That was who he was. He was always sort of rising above, seeing himself as a natural leader. Bobby Kennedy, to me, would have been an even more compelling figure, which was that of a parish priest.
Mm-hmm.
Because getting down with the grassroots is the way he related to the world.
What do you think it did to him to have his father have Joe Jr. and then Jack as the anointed ones who are going to have the presidency, and Bobby to be thought of, and I don't know if his father said this to him out loud, but to be thought of as the runt of the litter, the small one, the guy who wasn't very strong, who wasn't as smart.
Yes, so not only did he say it to him out loud, but he let him know when Bobby was young that as the middle child, as the smallest of his boys, that he was somebody that the dad didn't have high hopes for. Bobby, rather than being discouraged by that, a lot of people might have gone and pouted and been alienated from the family and particularly from the father. Bobby was just the opposite. He was always, the father was the one who mattered to him. Even though his mother was adoring and incredibly generous and kind to him, it was his dad who wouldn't give him the time of day that he wanted to please. So he worked harder than his brothers. He did more to please his father than any of the siblings, any of his eight siblings did. And in the end, even though Joe Jr. had been the anointed one, that Jack was the one who took Joe Jr.'s place when Joe Jr. died during World War II, it was Bobby who Joe Kennedy admitted was most like him. It was Bobby that he made the executor of his estate. And most importantly, there were three things that mattered to the Kennedys. One totem for them was being devout Catholics. Another was being loyal Democrats. But the one that mattered the most was being a Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy was the leader of the Klan in the way that Joe had been.
Mm-hmm. He would almost become obsessed with certain people. One was, and I want to ask you if he had a vendetta against Jimmy Hoffa, why he took on Jimmy Hoffa so fiercely and for such a long period of time.
So he took on Jimmy Hoffa. Bobby Kennedy made it very clear throughout his life the people he hated as well as the people he liked. And in the early days, there were three people who he truly detested. One was Roy Cohn, the young, arrogant aide to Joe McCarthy. A second was J. Edgar Hoover, the old, arrogant head of the FBI. And the third one, and the one Bobby was most passionate about in those days, was Jimmy Hoffa, the very powerful leader of the biggest union in America, the 1.3 million members, Teamsters. And Bobby, in, again, those early days, had a very clear sense of who the white hats were and who the black hats were. And Jimmy Hoffa was a definite bad guy. He was a guy that Bobby Kennedy saw as a corrupt union leader and somebody that he was darn well going to take on. And so it developed as an antagonism when Bobby was a young staffer to the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Investigations. He kept that passion up and that vendetta up when he was Attorney General. He finally helped send Jimmy Hoffa to jail. What Bobby could see was the downside of Hoffa. What he couldn't see was how much Hoffa, in his vehemence and doing what he thought was right, was so much like Bobby Kennedy.
Hmm.
Jimmy Hoffa, in fact, had built this union by being the union's, they called him the Teamster's Teamster, that unlike most union leaders who were corrupt and enriching themselves, Jimmy Hoffa did some bad things, but he never became rich, and he always remembered the working, stiff Teamster, which is why, even as Bobby Kennedy was chasing him down, the Teamster's members were reelecting him by overwhelming margins as their president.
Later on, when he was wondering if some of his actions as Attorney General, mostly as Attorney General, had resulted in the death of his brother, JFK, I believe there's a part of the book where he even wonders, maybe it was Hoffa because of how I treated him. Was Hoffa capable of doing anything like that? And was that a realistic thought on the part of Bobby Kennedy?
It was. So we were talking about Bobby Kennedy's enemies. Bobby Kennedy worried, I think, to the point where he had trouble sleeping at night after his brother Jack was assassinated. He worried whether he had set off a hornet's nest by messing with organized crime. And he went after organized crime in a way that no attorney general ever had and ever has since. He went after Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters. And Jimmy Hoffa had enough bad guy friends that that was a credible thing for Bobby to worry about. And Bobby Kennedy went after to the point of actually helping launch assassination plots against Cuban dictator Fidel Castro.
Right.
Bobby wondered whether Lee Harvey Oswald, who had been to Cuba and was a fan of Castro's, was it somehow something that he had done as Attorney General that had resulted in Castro launching a plot to kill his brother.
Hmm. He took on organized crime, but when there were family connections and substantial contributions to the Kennedy for President campaign in 1960, he steered clear of Frank Sinatra.
He did indeed. So generally, Bobby's record is one in the early days as well as in the later days of more good than bad, but there was always a little bit of the bad sprinkled in. And the bad with organized crime was just what you said, which is, we're going to go after you. We're going to go after you whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, unless you're just at that level where you're a bit too close. So he didn't go after Frank Sinatra, even though his prosecutors thought he should. He didn't fire J. Edgar Hoover, because J. Edgar Hoover had enough dirt on the Kennedys, even though Bobby knew that they should fire Hoover. Too many things got delayed. The standard line from Jack Kennedy in those days was, let's wait till 1964 and I'm reelected, and then I'll take on the really tough issues.
Mm-hmm. There were so many, and this is the part of the book, and I think the part of him that so resonated with me and journalists who loved him during that time period and people who were just drawn to him. And I love these stories in your book, his visits to the Mississippi Delta, the issues facing American Indians, this idea, and you say this in the book, that it had to do with justice, with a small J, and I think Kennedy said this, doing right and being fair by these people that we've pushed around for so long. He says that about American Indians. Many tribes adored him. And a lot of other people, when I worked in the South, there was a picture of JFK and Martin Luther King and sometimes Bobby Kennedy. Other audiences, other people who had been pushed around for so long, they felt he was going to help them. And he did help people.
He did. So can I take a second and tell that Mississippi Delta story?
Yeah, please do.
Again, that's emblematic. And I was also in the South as a journalist in both Kentucky and Alabama. And on the one hand, 80% of the people that I ran into when I told them I was from Massachusetts and that I liked Kennedys, they were shocked and they were outraged. 20% did exactly what you said. They were people who not only had Jack's picture, but often had Bobby's picture in their house, because they understood he stood for something. And what he stood for was very apparent when he was at a set of hearings of a committee that he was on in Washington, where the senators, this is when he was a U.S. senator starting in 1964, and the hearings were in 1966, and the hearings talked about hunger in the South and hunger in America generally. And the committee was so shocked by what it heard, and especially by what it heard from a young African-American civil rights lawyer from Mississippi named Marion Wright, who is today Marion Wright Edelman.
Yes.
So she convinced them to come to Jackson and get a closer look at what was going on. And they all did. And they go to Mississippi, they listen to the hearing in Jackson, they hear about these horrible problems that Americans are actually starving, that it requires a small amount of money, a couple bucks generally, to buy food stamps. So you're starving and you don't have any food, but you have to pay for the food stamps to keep you from starving. And she said, this is horrible. There are people with no income and people are starving. All the senators listened. All the senators were alarmed. And all but two of the senators flew back to Washington for their weekend of comfortable living back home. Two senators, Bobby Kennedy and a guy named Joe Clark, said, we've heard about it. Now we want to see it. Marion Wright and a few others take them to one of the great breadbaskets of America, the Mississippi Delta, also one of the great poverty enclaves of America, where tenant farming there was almost like a return to slavery. Bobby Kennedy goes into one particular shack that was extraordinary, and he thought nobody was watching, but in fact, a couple journalists were watching him. And he goes into the shack. There's a family living there where there's a clothesline strung on the dirt floor living room. There's in the refrigerator a jar of peanut butter. Mm. And on the floor is a toddler with a distended stomach that suggests that this is a kid who's suffering from malnutrition. Bobby Kennedy, in his business suit, gets down on the floor with this kid. And for the next 15 minutes, in the way that no politician that I know ever does, he was trying to make contact with this little boy at eye level. He doesn't notice that there are flies flying overhead. Nobody notices, he thinks, that there are tears streaming down his face. And while he can't really get the kid to focus, because that's what the kid is all about, he goes outside of that shack. He lectures people outside on what he had just seen. And most importantly, he goes back to Washington, and the next Monday, he meets with the Secretary of Agriculture, and he gets him to change the rules of the food stamp program so that people who have no money don't need money to buy food stamps, and there are fewer hungry people starving. And as importantly, that Sunday afternoon, he goes home to his family at this enormous, magnificent estate called Hickory Hill, where Bobby and his wife and their eventually 11 kids lived. He tells his kids, who are sitting there in their dining room with a chandelier and fine china, you have a responsibility. There are dozens of people living in rooms the size of our living room, and you have a responsibility at some point in your life to make a difference to those people. The speech was so compelling that 2 weeks ago, when my book came out, Kathleen Kennedy, his oldest child, was at my book talk, and she recited verbatim everything that Bobby had said that day.
Really?
So this is a senator who got down with little kids. This is a senator who, when he got outraged, did something to make a difference. And this is a senator with his own family who preached. He was preaching, in a sense, to himself. He knew he had been raised with lots of silver spoons, and he felt for the rest of his life that he had to do something to give back, and he did.
Our guest this hour is Larry Tai. His book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Our phone number, we'll take some calls, and we have a lot of territory to cover, is 800-486-8655. We do have a few of Bobby Kennedy's words, and one of them actually just happens to be about that trip to the Mississippi Delta. Here's what he had to say.
What we have here, of course, is a considerable amount of hunger. We have the children with distended stomachs. In the large cities of the country, particularly in the north, where there is poverty, still people can live on welfare so that the children don't suffer. Here, children as well as grown-ups are suffering, and as well as the housing being, of course, completely inadequate and without any schooling because of the fact that the children have insufficient clothing. So, as I say, I think it's a terrible reflection on our society. I think that one of the great problems is for most of us as American citizens, we don't run across it. We don't, for a citizen living under reasonably good conditions in our big cities, we don't pass through Bedford-Stuyvesant. We don't pass through Harlem. For a citizen living here in the state of Mississippi, you don't ordinarily run up against, if you're doing reasonably well, you don't run up against this kind of poverty.
And we'll hear about the work that he did in Bedford-Stuyvesant as well as we carry on and take your phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Tai is with us this hour, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Let's, as with everything with Bobby Kennedy, the truth is nuanced and complicated. Let's talk about Bobby Kennedy and civil rights, his relationship with Martin Luther King, his role, Bobby's role in the March on Washington in 1963. But this growing awareness, and he's taken to task, if you would tell us the story of the group that James Baldwin pulled together. He's on the defensive because he's being told that his administration is not doing enough. And he doesn't initially listen, but eventually the words have been absorbed.
So, yes, he's having a meeting at his father's apartment on Central Park in New York with James Baldwin and with lots of other prominent African Americans. The meeting, from Bobby's point of view, is this is early in his tenure as Attorney General when he is relatively clueless on the issue of civil rights. And the meeting is to talk about, he hopes, all the great things the Kennedy administration has been doing early in its tenure on civil rights. And he wants, he calls these people together. He wants sort of a candid discussion, he says, on civil rights leaders, the big ones of whom have not been invited to the meeting, and he's asking people like the famous actor James Baldwin, the actor and writer, all kinds of prominent playwrights and people from the African-American world, but not so much activists, to give him feedback. Mm-hmm. He says he wants honesty, he really wants compliments, and what he gets instead is a lecture on all that the Kennedy administration hasn't been doing and all that needs to be done. And a lecture, especially by a young civil rights leader who's been beat up in the Freedom Rides trying to integrate interstate transportation, and this guy named Jerome Smith tells Bobby that if you lose young people like me who believe in the system, if you don't help us, then there's going to be heck to pay. And Bobby Kennedy is shocked, and he's shocked that older leaders like Baldwin don't stand up for him. He's shocked that anybody would dare to criticize what he thinks is the goodwill of his brother and of him. And mostly, he's shocked because that's not the persona, the self-image that Bobby, who thinks of himself as a good guy, has of himself. His first reaction is to sort of strike out and to tell people, essentially, you know, the welcome mat is up and you can't treat your attorney general that way. But as always happens with him, there's the first reaction, which is anger, and the second reaction, which, as you said, was listening. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, those wouldn't mean anything unless there was a third reaction. And the third reaction was that after an initial relatively weak record, by the end of his tenure as attorney general, there was no attorney general who had ever done more in America for civil rights. And by the end of his life, I can say without hyperbole that there was no white person in all of America who was more popular in black America than Robert Francis Kennedy. And one of the people, ironically, who hadn't been invited to that meeting with great intent on Bobby's part, because he isn't especially like him, was a guy named Martin Luther King Jr. And Martin Luther King saw, even when most of the civil rights leaders couldn't see, that there was good in this guy, Bobby Kennedy, and he told his young lieutenants, it is our responsibility to figure out a way to bring out that good, and he did.
What kind of control did he have? Because obviously he was worried what could happen at the March on Washington, which turned out to be very moving and very important. But he played a significant role in making sure that happened because he thought about all the what-ifs, didn't he?
He did. And he was worried that if something bad happened, if there were riots in Washington, if blacks and whites couldn't get along during the march, that it would be a setback in the civil rights bill that he wanted to eventually see pass into the civil rights movement generally. It would be an embarrassment to his brother, and it would be a setback to the movement. And so what he did, it was classic Bobby. Behind the scenes, he had his people there at every potential point of conflict, organizing down to the level of detail to make sure there were enough food stands open that day, that people who came in from out of town were not hungry or thirsty, to make sure that most of the buses that were bringing in African Americans from surrounding communities across America or their white supporters would not spend the night in Washington, that they'd head back home that night. He, down to every level of detail, even to the point of having the public address system ready to be cut off if somebody said something too inflammatory during the actual speeches as part of the march. So Bobby was behind the scenes. He didn't want his invisible hand of control seen with any of this, but he wasn't going to take anything by chance. And he was watching with all of his top aides on television monitors from his office at the Justice Department, and it worked. His work behind the scenes, all the work of the civil rights leaders, King and his allies, made sure that march was the most brilliant march ever held and was a symbol of what could happen when whites and blacks work together rather than a point of resentment for the reactionary movement.
Mm. Why did he wiretap Martin Luther King?
Well, that's an interesting question, and he did it for two reasons. Legitimately, Bobby Kennedy was presented with evidence, not good evidence, and not what I think is evidence that he should have accepted, but enough of it by J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, that Martin Luther King had leftists on his staff, and Bobby was worried that if there were communist infiltration of the civil rights movement, it would be devastating to the movement as well as to Jack Kennedy. On the other hand, Bobby Kennedy should have known better than anybody in the world just how unreliable evidence presented like that from J. Edgar Hoover was. J. Edgar Hoover played Bobby, and Bobby let himself be played and agreed to Hoover's request. He resisted at the beginning, and he finally agreed to wiretap Martin Luther King.
Let's go to some calls. We have many of them coming in. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I just give a caveat. I grew up Irish Catholic in Boston in the 60s, so the Kennedys, it was tribal. They were our people. I have a couple of questions from your guest's perspective. He's probably heard the phrase that Jack Kennedy was the first Irish Brahmin and that Bobby was the last Irish Puritan. What does he think of that comment? What does he think about Bobby's speech in Indianapolis on the night Martin Luther King was died? And then one final question, 56 years later after Jack Kennedy's election, we haven't had a Catholic president. Any thoughts on that? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jim.
Great. I love it. So you must be a reporter. You're not only a good Boston Irish guy, but you managed to sneak in three questions as one, and I like all three of them. So I'm going to try to be brief with these. The question about the Brahmin versus the Puritan, that is precisely who Bobby was. It was a brilliant line that I quoted in my book and that has been around for a long time about Bobby. It supposedly first came from ex-governor of Massachusetts, Deaver, and that was what I was trying to say about the Pope versus the parish priest. Bobby was the consummate Puritan. That was the way he saw the world. It was black and white, and he was the down-and-dirty guy, and Jack Kennedy was above the fray. In terms of what happened with that speech, if I could tell a really brief story about that speech in Indianapolis, because it was one of the most important speeches Bobby gave in his life.
Mm-hmm.
He was campaigning in 1968 for president. The first contested primary was the state of Indiana. He flies in one night to Indianapolis, and he's greeted by a couple aides and by the mayor of Indianapolis, a guy who went on to become a powerful senator named Richard Lugar. And they say, Martin Luther King has been shot and killed. The mayor says to Bobby, you will not go into the ghetto because you will kick off a riot in my city and you might not make it out alive. Bobby listens to that advice and says, here I go. He goes into the middle of the black ghetto, jumps up on the back of a flatbed truck, and for the next 5 minutes delivers the most pitch-perfect speech on race relations that a white politician has ever given in a situation like that.
Let me hold you there for a moment, Larry, and pick up the story. We have part of that, and I wanted people to hear it because it is an incredible moment. Bobby Kennedy in Indianapolis.
But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
The moment that always gets to me in that speech, and I've heard it so many times, is when he talks about this anger, justified anger you may have. Reports are that the person who killed MLK was white. And then he talks about the person who was white who killed his brother, too. And it just, it can make you cry. How many years later?
So I've heard that speech about 50 times, and I can't help but crying each time.
Mm-hmm.
And what he actually says that night, and it was extraordinary, he won't say the word Jack Kennedy. He won't say my brother. He
right.
says somebody close to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he still can't manage to quite come out and talk about it explicitly, but it is the first time he's ever in a public setting made reference to his brother's death. He went into that community to embrace the community over its loss of Martin Luther King, and people who were there that night ended up embracing him over the loss of his brother. In 100 cities across America, there were race riots that night. The only big city with a substantial African-American population that didn't riot was Indianapolis, and that was because Bobby Kennedy found the words that night that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and Barack Obama have been trying to find in our era of Baton Rouge and Dallas, and have not been able to quite come up with the thing that Bobby did. From that moment until the end of the campaign in 1968, there were signs that greeted him in every black community he went that said, white, but all right. And that may not sound like much, but in those days, the idea that anybody would greet any white politician with that. So that is the second question that your caller asked. The last question, I'm going to be even shorter. The last question was, why haven't we had another Catholic president? And the only thing I would say there is keep an eye on Bobby Kennedy's grandson.
Really?
Joseph T. Kennedy III, a young congressman from the Boston area, who is the closest thing that that family has produced to a Robert Francis Kennedy. Keep an eye on him.
All right. Thanks for the tip there, Larry. Let's go to Nathan next. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. This is wonderful. I just wanted to say this has been a fascinating topic. My kind of two questions about one topic are about the extent of McCarthy's relationship with the rest of the Kennedy clan. McCarthy was kind of part of the Hyannisport entourage, and I was wondering kind of the depth of his relationship with the rest of the Kennedy family. And also on the point of communism, what was the reaction of the rest of the family to Kennedy kind of coming out against the apartheid regime in South Africa at a time when South Africa, you know, was seen as a major ally against communism, you know, the ANC within South Africa and all of that?
So the first question is that, as you suggest, we're talking about there were two McCarthys in Bobby's life. In a later life, it was Senator Gene McCarthy from your part of the country, and in an earlier time, it was Senator Joseph McCarthy, also from your part of the country. And we're talking about Joe McCarthy's relationship with Joe Kennedy was close enough that every time Joe McCarthy was in Palm Beach, he'd stop by the Kennedy compound there for a drink. Anytime he could, he would flirt with one of the Kennedy girls and try to take out two of Bobby's sisters. He was close enough to John F. Kennedy that John F. Kennedy used his back operation and his time in the hospital as an excuse not to have to come out and decide whether to vote for a censure of Joe McCarthy. So very close to the family. Bobby was just following in the family's footsteps, and yet, as always, Bobby was, whatever the issue was, the most passionate about them, including about anti-communism, and therefore the most passionate about Joe McCarthy. The question about South Africa, one of the great Bobby speeches, right up there with the speech he gave to his kids about the Mississippi Delta and the speech he gave to the black community in Indianapolis and the eve of Martin Luther King's death. The other great speech of his life was the speech, the famous so-called Ripple of Hope speech that he gave to apartheid South Africa at a moment when blacks and whites, liberal whites and all of the blacks in South Africa needed a sense that the world cared. No better way for the world to show that it cared than through America's first family, the Kennedys. And by that time, which was during Bobby's Senate career, the Kennedys and most of liberal America, at least, were on board, no matter what kind of an ally South Africa was against communism, were on board that apartheid was an evil system. And Bobby Kennedy did what no other white politician in America or in the world had the courage to do. He went to South Africa and on its doorstep gave them the painful message, you got to end this system of racial discrimination.
And we'll, I think we picked the right speeches. We happen to have a part of that on tape, too, and we'll play that in just a little while. I do want to move to the assassination of his brother. Your book has so much in it. I hope people will read it, but it was such a blow to him, and you write pretty vividly about how he went into this very serious, deep depression, didn't want to talk, crying a lot, couldn't sleep, and what got him out of it, but how deep that depression became.
So that depression, Bobby Kennedy, in the instant of his brother's assassination, lost his best friend, his brother, and his whole sense of purpose in the world. He had defined himself professionally by his brother from the earliest congressional campaign that Jack ran in when Bobby was helping with that campaign. He ran his campaign for Senate, he ran his campaign for president, and he was the closest thing to a co-president that we have ever, or I think will ever have in this country. So Jack's loss was an epiphany moment in Bobby's life. It was a moment that sent him into a deep depression that lasted for 6 or 7 months until he finally came out of it during his campaign for senator from New York. But it was also a moment that changed everything for Bobby. We are all, Kathleen, some combination of tough and tender. And the dial on Bobby Kennedy, which in the Joe McCarthy days was tilted way over to the tough side, began to become more tender. As we heard in the speech that Bobby gave in Indianapolis, he was not only reading, he was quoting Aeschylus and the Greek tragedies. Jackie Kennedy had pointed him to the Greek tragedies. It was enough for Bobby Kennedy to be reading books in those days post-assassination, and the idea that it was Greek tragedy to people who knew him was a bit shocking. He was more sensitive to the underdog. He had a sense that everything that you had with hubris could come crashing down, and he had seen it come crashing down around him. And so he was a very different person from that moment of the assassination to the rest of his life than he had been before. All the roots were there, but they came out and were expressed in a different way.
Mm. And it seemed as though he became alive again when he made the decision to run for Senate.
Well, actually, you're half right. He became alive again after he decided to run for Senate. But in the beginning of the campaign, he was still in that deep funk. He was convinced that people were only coming out to his rallies because he was Jack's pathetic younger brother who had lost his brother. It was only in the point midway through that campaign in October of 1964 when Bobby had a sense that for the first time ever, a Kennedy could actually lose an election. That was enough to pull him out of the depression, to begin to realize that the crowds were there for him, and to go on to beat a popular incumbent senator and become the most effective Kennedy ever to serve in the Senate. That Jack Kennedy was a mediocre senator. Ted Kennedy, in 50 years, I think spent his 50 years in the Senate becoming quite effective, but during those 50 years always trying to be Bobby. And Bobby, who was only a senator for fewer than 4 years, got more done and stood up for more important causes, from ending the war to ending poverty, than anybody in his family had done and than most people in the history of the Senate had done.
Yeah. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. Larry Tai is our guest. He is author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Josh in Ashland. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing well. Yeah, I appreciate the talk here. My question has to do with something that's been touched on a few times, liberal anti-communism. And, you know, one thing is to mention J. Edgar Hoover saying there were possibly leftists within the civil rights movement. And also in South Africa, and that, you know, apartheid existed for how many decades after that, two or three decades. And the Soviet Union supported the ANC and many of the independent movement in Africa. And, you know, Martin Luther King, as far as I know, his last public address was on the first anniversary of W.E.B. Du Bois' death. And some of these bad guys, even people, Communist Party members, were like Paul Robeson and W.E. Du Bois. And I think there's a whole thing that's lost there within liberal anti-communism of the contribution of the left to racial justice in the United States and the world.
Yes. So I'm really glad that that call came in, because I think that, first of all, Bobby Kennedy wasn't necessarily a liberal in his early days, but he became and gave credence to the notion that liberals could also be worried about legitimate threats from the Soviet Union. But I think his life, one of the reasons you write a biography is only partly to examine the life of the person you've chosen to write a biography on. It is partly also to use that person's life as a lens into bigger and more telling issues about who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Kennedy's life in the 1950s, his Cold Warrior days, were lens into who America was in the 1950s. Democrats and Republicans shared the goal of anti-communism. You read the hearing transcripts from the McCarthy Committee, and you can't tell who was a Democrat and who was a Republican. People we thought of as liberal senators back then, when Bobby was a young staffer with them, were as virulently anti-communist as Joe McCarthy was. They didn't necessarily trample on civil liberties the way he did. The methods differed, but the goals were the same. As America was changing from the conservative era of Eisenhower into the tumultuous 1960s, Bobby Kennedy was a lead indicator of that change. He was out in front of many of the issues of the change. He was against the Vietnam War before most of America was. But where he was where America was going, which raises the great what if.
Yes.
What if he had lived? What if, as I think
he had been the Democratic nominee? What if, as I think, there was no American who knew more about Richard Nixon and his vulnerabilities in 1968 than the guy who 8 years before
ran against him,
led the campaign against him? Exactly.
Right.
So I think it's not a stretch to think that Bobby Kennedy would have been the president in 1968, and that raises the biggest and the most fun what-if of all. Would we be revisiting the same issues of racial strife and of all the strife in America today in the same way had we had a president who was willing to take them on head first in 1968? Mm-hmm. And the answer is none of us know, but it sure is something interesting to think about.
And Michael Harrington thought that he would change the direction of America, didn't he?
So I think Michael Harrington thought that and that he was right.
Mm. Let's go next. Thanks, Josh, for your call. Judy in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. This is wonderful because I am truly a native New York City person. And during my 20s living in New York, I was a volunteer for his Senate campaign, his presidential campaign, and in the presidential campaign, particularly involved in the Kennedy Action Corps, which were Return Peace Corps, anti-poverty, and civil rights volunteers. And I've got the buttons, all the buttons. I've got his speeches. I've got the newsletters. And many of us met after he was murdered. And most of us felt pretty hopeless about America after that. And I do believe that things would have been different. There's been no one like him.
Larry.
So can I just have a couple quick responses to that? I love the story. I want to tell the caller that she should save those buttons because they are true treasures. And I want to just remind listeners what John Lewis said. When John Lewis, the 90-something-year-old congressman from Georgia and the voice of conscience of civil rights today in America, he was a protege of Martin Luther King Jr.'s. When Martin Luther King was shot, John Lewis said, "This is devastating, but at least we have Bobby Kennedy." When Bobby Kennedy, a few months later, was shot, John Lewis just lay in his bed crying. I think that many of us have spent the last 50 years looking for a tough liberal, or if you prefer, a tender conservative, that Bobby Kennedy represented in 1968, and I think we're still looking.
Thank you very much. And another comment from Melody on Facebook. My heart broke when Bobby was assassinated. I was raised in California. I was in junior high, hemming my drill team uniform, and had just watched him speak on TV. 1968 was a bad year for our country. We lost a lot, and she thinks we haven't recovered yet.
So I think you should do another show with just your, you don't need me, your...
Oh, your we listeners. Need you.
Stories. Their stories are so great, and all of our heart broke. We thought that
yes.
we couldn't be more devastated than we were losing Jack Kennedy and Martin Luther King, but there was something magical about Bobby. He had a passion, and he had a youthfulness mm-hmm. that in most of our minds, the image of Bobby Kennedy will always be that incredibly young-looking 42-year-old guy who was taken away from us in 1968.
How true. And we were looking at YouTube today, some of the old video. He was so young when he gave that speech in South Africa. He was just so young. He had
he was.
So many
and
more
you
years.
Want to feel old. You want to feel old, you consider the fact that last November, Bobby would have turned 90.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Larry, we're going to end with his speech in South Africa. I want to thank you very much. You know, I'd love to have you on again sometime. I feel like there are all these stories that we never got to because he lived so hard and so much in the short period of time he was on Earth. It's pretty remarkable.
So I'm delighted that you had me on, and I think that speech is the way to go out.
Thank you so much for being with us. The author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, Larry Tye, who covered the Kennedys for the Boston Globe for quite some time. And after a thorough examination of all the good and all the problematic with Bobby Kennedy, came out as a strong advocate for him and who he was. So this, we've mentioned this speech a couple times, one of the great ones that Bobby Kennedy gave and threw everybody off guard because the way he started. This is in South Africa.
I come here this evening because of my deep interest and affection for a land settled by the Dutch in the mid-17th century then taken over by the British and at last independent. A land in which the native inhabitants were at first subdued, but relations with whom remain a problem to this day. A land which defined itself on a hostile frontier. A land which has tamed rich natural resources through the energetic application of modern technology. A land which was once the importer of slaves and now must struggle to wipe out the last traces of that form of bondage. I refer, of course, to the United States of America.
Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again for All Things Political Monday.